From New Jersey to Kansas, Florida to California, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, protests that turn into riots, rallies that turn into insurrections. America has experienced several years of rage. Why is anger dominating the national culture? Peter Wood is author of Wrath, America Enraged. He is here to discuss. A third of the U.S. Senate and all members of the House of Representatives are up for election this year. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story on the most competitive races. Inflation and rising interest rates are going to make the national debt even more difficult to manage. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Brian Riedel of the Manhattan Institute. And Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA wishes you shalom, peace, in 2022 on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry. Happy New Year, and hopefully a year with less anger on the streets than we have seen over the past several years. How has that anger come to dominate our national discourse? For the answer, we turn to Peter Wood. Peter is president of the National Association of Scholars. He is also author of the new book, Wrath, America Enraged. Peter, welcome to American Radio Journal. Peter, there was a time in American politics where after presidential elections, for the most part, not everybody, but for the most part, the country came together. That hasn't been the case lately. How is it that this anger has now dominated our American scene here over really the last decade or so?
Well, it has leapt out of popular culture into our politics. Politics is always a place where anger can easily take root. But our founders, knowing that, put in place a system that encouraged people to leave the political debates on the floor of the House or Senate and become more or less cordial to each other afterwards. But that's been in the works for a long time in the form of a change that attributes to people more power, more significance, more authenticity if they just live their lives angry all the time. And after simmering in popular culture for decades, starting in around the time of Bush-Gore election, 2000, it began to become a really significant part of how we handle ourselves in elections. And I think we've now seen that reach its peak. It's hard to imagine it going much further than this, but the visceral anger of the left over Trump's win in 2016 and the anger of the right over Biden's election last year has taken us to a new place where the ability to sort of call things back to civil order has pretty much evaporated.
The passing of Senator Bob Dole here a couple of weeks ago, Peter, it really evoked a bygone era. And of course, we have at different times during our history, if anybody studies presidential history, we have had some pretty vitriolic elections, and there have been after effects from those elections that have lasted for years. But this change, as you mentioned, sort of happened around the turn of the century. How is this anger that we're seeing now different from what we have seen in the past?
Well, I think it's different in several ways. I'll start by saying that it's now what I call new anger, a performative anger that people take pride in being angry. And there was a time, not that long ago, where being angry in public too often or too intensely was a matter of shame. People didn't think that the angry person was very reliable, and people could be sort of written out of polite company for over-expressing anger. So one thing that's changed for sure is that no one feels that shame anymore. Showing off your anger and expecting to be applauded for it is the new thing. So there's that. The second thing is there has been a change, I think, with the 2020 election and the January 6th riot and the aftermath of that in the form of characterizing the people involved in the fracas as terrorists or engaged in insurrection has taken a very large segment of the American public to the position where nothing they can say or do is legitimate in the eyes of their government. We no longer have this idea of a loyal opposition that needs to be respected, even if it's disagreed with. And that's where I came into it. I began to watch the outcome of the 2020 election with some suspicion, and then realized that those suspicions can't even be named without inciting a reaction on the part of those who favored the outcome as you're unacceptable. We will not talk to you. You have no voice. You have no platform. You will be canceled from social media, and so on. That elimination of the ability to express disagreement, even angry disagreement, produces something else. I call it wrath in my book. Wrath is anger that has been bottled up and not permitted any form of expression or development as a form of, in politest term, I guess we would call it dialogue, but forget dialogue, just the ability to have your say has gone out of our political equation, and that has resulted in something very ugly, this sense that the other side is not an opponent but an enemy, and nothing is left to do but to try to eradicate that enemy. So that's new. I mean, Americans, of course, fought a civil war. We were founded in a revolution. We're no strangers to really strong disagreement, but we are kind of in new territory with this discovery that being angry is a lifestyle, that this is something that we can take pride in wanting to demonize our opponents as people who are unbearable. And that, I think, is where we've landed.
The book, of course, is entitled Wrath, America Enraged. And Peter, are there occasions where this wrath is justified?
Well, in my view, yes. I think wrath is a dangerous thing to deal with. If it's allowed to go its own course, it can destroy the person who is wrathful, as well as the people that the wrathful one dislikes. But nonetheless, it's a way of focusing attention where attention needs to be paid. I'm among those who think that there was mischief in the 2020 election. Without some degree of wrath, we're not going to answer that problem. We're not going to get back to a place where the majority of Americans can take confidence that an election produced a real result and not something that was pasted together. Same thing with the riot on Capitol Hill on January 6th. It resulted in our Capitol being surrounded by barbed wire for several months. The National Guard was called out. Rumors were spread by the government of impending militaristic attacks on the nation. Things which were totally imaginary, but which served the purpose of driving people into ostracism. That, I think, does require a wrathful response, but the wrath needs to be channeled into something that is actually constructive. Now, the constructive parts of it aren't hard to find. That means participating, maybe ardently, in elections, doing what you can to ensure that the elections are on the up and up, being able to go out and protest if you need to, and protest without a threat of violence on either side. Ultimately, it involves a willingness to engage in old-fashioned civil disobedience, just saying some laws are unjust and we're not going to obey them. We will take the consequences of not obeying them, and the consequences may be time in jail or arrest or getting beat up or something like that. But that's where wrath needs to go. It needs to go into this willingness to say no and make that no stick.
We have been talking with Peter Wood, and Peter is president of the National Association of Scholars. He's also author of the new book, Wrath, America Enraged.
The book is widely available in bookstores and through Amazon and through the publisher, which is encounterbooks.com. Happy to say that it's doing well. The National Association of Scholars is a organization that's about 35 years old of academics mainly, about 4,000 of us around the country who are kind of the remnant of those who believe in old-fashioned liberal education and freedom of thought and freedom of speech and pursuit of truth.
Peter Wood, author of Wrath, America Enraged. Peter, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. This week, he's going to take us around the country as we take a look at key United States Senate and United States House of Representative races that will take place in 2022. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be back, Loman. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the Senate, where right now we are tied 50-50 in the United States Senate, but a very important election year coming up. What states are going to be key to the ultimate partisan divide in the United States Senate?
Well, you're right. We've got a 50-50 Senate right now. Republicans have 20 races in play, and Democrats have 14. You always have one-third of the United States Senate that is up for re-election, and with these six-year terms that are stacked every 2 years with various classes. So right now, we know that there's a bunch of really, really big, expensive swing states that are in play for the 2022 election. And in a 50-50 Senate, Republicans need to go on offense and pick up some of those difficult blue states in order to win back the Senate majority. The biggest races that I'm following, obviously, are currently Republican seats, but you've got North Carolina with Ted Budd against Pat McCrory. North Carolina has recently had a court step in and delay their election from March 8th all the way back to May. You've also got Ohio, where Josh Mandel is in a crowded field against Jane Timken and Bernie Marino and J.D. Vance and Mike Gibbons. And within that race, they're likely to take on Tim Ryan in the general election. But I feel good about obviously holding both those seats in the Senate elections for 2022. A big, big purple state that Republicans have to defend or else they will not win back the majority is your home state of Pennsylvania. That continues to be a wide open race with new entrants coming forth. We talked a few weeks ago about Dr. Oz and David McCormick getting in the race. You also have Ambassador Carla Sands and several other candidates that are currently running and even some former members that are still taking a look at getting in. Within the rest of the country, in Georgia, Herschel Walker will undoubtedly be the Republican nominee running against Raphael Warnock, a first-term senator that was elected in that runoff election last January. Herschel Walker is obviously doing a good job of raising money, but so is Raphael Warnock. And the Democratic machine is proving that even for some of these lackluster, sort of unknown Democratic senators, you've got the ability to funnel through ActBlue and other fundraising platforms an enormous amount of money from their grassroots activism. Then you kind of go west, and we've got a big, big race in Arizona where Senator Mark Kelly is up for election, and he will be facing either Jim Lehman or Mick McGuire or Blake Masters. You've also got the Attorney General Brunovich. So I think that's a big, big primary, and who wins that primary is going to largely determine whether or not that's a pickup opportunity. Obviously, we feel good about the nature of the political winds right now across America. I think there's other states in play, like Nevada. The Club for Growth PAC has endorsed Adam Laxalt in that race against Jackie Rosen. And whether or not New Hampshire gets in play with Maggie Hassan running for re-election, I'm not sure who the Republican candidate will be there, but that's a big, big, important race. A couple other wide-open Republican races to keep your eye on. In Alabama, Mo Brooks is facing Katie Britt, a former chief of staff to longtime Senator Richard Shelby. Mo Brooks was obviously one of the conservatives in the House Freedom Caucus, running for statewide office for the second time. And the Club for Growth PAC is also supporting his candidacy. In Missouri, we've got Attorney General Eric Schmidt against former Governor Eric Greitens. So that's sort of a battle of the Erics, even though there's a few other candidates in the race, including Congressman Billy Long, Congresswoman Vicki Hartzler, and also the Second Amendment activist from the Missouri protests, Mark McCloskey, who was known for sort of defending his ground in his gated community. And then if you're talking about stretch states that in a Republican wave might get into play, you remember way back in the 2010 election, Republicans actually won Illinois with Mark Kirk. They also won Colorado with Cory Gardner. These are states that typically are blue, but I know Republicans at the National Republican Senatorial Committee underneath the leadership of Senator Rick Scott are hoping to put more of those blue states into play.
Over in the United States Senate, Scott, Republicans only down three seats, a very narrow minority in the House of Representatives. And typically, in this first year, the off year of a new presidential term, the elections go very heavily to the opposing party. So that, added with all the retirements that have been coming from the Democrat side, I assume Republican hopes are riding pretty high right now.
Yeah, we actually recently saw a pretty massive retirement down in Florida where one of the more moderate Democrats, again, I've talked previously about how the Democratic Party is taking this leftward lunge and leaving some of these members that have sort of a firm foundation of being a centrist. And Stephanie Murphy in the 7th Congressional District of Florida recently announced that she was retiring. And so we're up to, I think, 27 different Democrats that are passing on running for re-election. Now, obviously, in some of those seats, those are dark blue seats that there will be a Democrat elected. Then there's also seats that are in play to totally be flipped. And there's also competitive races where some of these incumbents are refusing to step away from their elected power and they're willing to put it out on the line. And so we're watching for, I think, a Republican wave in the House of Representatives.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. We are going to, throughout the year, keep an eye on all of these races here on American Radio Journal. Scott, tell us a bit about the Club.
Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington. Today I was talking a little bit about our elective priorities, and those are run through our Political Action Committee, the Club for Growth PAC. If anybody wants to check us out and see which candidates we've been endorsing in some of the biggest races in America, our website is clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you again for being here.
Thank you.
Consumers are feeling the pinch of inflation and rising interest rates, but those trends also are impacting repayment of the national debt. For details, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine turns to Brian Riedel of the Manhattan Institute.
About 2 years ago, in January of 2020, so you know, right before everything happened, I interviewed today's guest, and he warned me about two things when it came to the national debt. One, he said that if we had a recession or some sort of economic downturn in the near future, we could see deficits hit $2 trillion. And of course, later that year, we hit a federal deficit well in excess of $3 trillion thanks to pandemic spending and borrowing. And the second thing he said was that if interest rates rise, then the national debt could go from being a serious concern to being one that becomes much more difficult to address, because higher interest rates mean that the national debt, like all debts, will become more expensive to pay. And so now here we are, 2 years later, with higher debt, higher deficits, and the prospect of rising interest rates all staring America in the face as we begin 2022. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. Happy New Year to you, although not the happiest of subjects today that we're going to talk about with my guest, Brian Riedel. He's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and before that, a longtime Senate staffer, a Senate budget staffer, who has spent a lot of time thinking and writing and trying to get people to care more about the national debt than they do. And he joins us now on the phone to talk about all of this. Brian, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Thank you, Eric.
So this is maybe the only topic out there that is less fun to talk about than COVID right now, and that is the amount of money that we've spent, not just fighting COVID, but on lots of other things over the last few decades. Brian, you've been tracking this, as I said, for a long time, but give us, before we talk about what's to come, give us a little bit of the context here of what the federal government has done over the last 2 years, largely in response to the pandemic. How much more debt have we added since this all got started in March of 2020?
When you and I spoke a couple of years ago on this, the debt was $17 trillion. And since then, it has already jumped to about $23.5 trillion in a span of just 2 years. About half of that is COVID spending. Another half is just baseline deficits. And the danger is that under just the baseline of continued deficits and some of the stuff that the president wants, we could surpass $40 trillion a decade from now. So we might be in a situation where in about a 12-year period, we go from $17 trillion to more than $40 trillion in debt.
The argument that I always hear when I bring this up with my more liberal friends is that, you know, oh, well, hey, don't worry about it because it's so cheap to borrow. And look, this is, I think, a legitimate point in some ways. It's so cheap to borrow money. It's so cheap for the federal government to borrow money that, like, we're leaving money on the table if we don't do it, right? We might as well borrow it because it's there to be borrowed.
Yeah, the problems with that argument are twofold. First off, even if we don't do any additional legislation, we're on pace to borrow $112 trillion over the next 30 years, even if you don't do any more spending bills. So it's not a case for more spending when you're already going to be in that much debt. And anyone with a student loan can tell you that when you're in debt that much, even low interest rates can't save you. Your monthly payment is still going to be high, even with low interest rates, when you're going to owe that much. But the other danger is, why do we assume that interest rates will stay low forever? One thing a lot of people don't realize is that the federal government borrows overwhelmingly using short-term debt, which means if interest rates rise at any point in the future, within a couple years, the entire national debt will roll over into those higher interest rates. And the numbers are actually quite staggering. Every point that interest rates rise over the CBO baseline projection would add $30 trillion in 30 years in interest costs. And in my report, I run the numbers on what the debt would look like over the next 30 years under various interest rates. And what I find is that, first, even low interest rates won't save us. The debt and interest costs and deficits will still rise because of the baseline deficits. But also, if interest rates do rise, we would face a severe fiscal crisis.
We're chatting with Brian Riedel. He's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and he is, as he just mentioned, the author of a new report, How Higher Interest Rates Could Push Washington Towards a Federal Debt Crisis. You can find that at manhattaninstitute.org. Brian, again, this is a thing that you've been warning about for a while, the idea that interest rates have been at historically low levels, and if they rise, we end up owing a lot more on the national debt. Now we've got a period of inflation here, and there's talk that the Federal Reserve could respond to that by raising interest rates a little bit. Are you concerned about even just a very small rise in interest rates? Is this just the beginning of something larger to come? Where's your level of concern about that?
Yeah, my concern is the Federal Reserve raising interest rates is probably the right move for the current economy. But fiscal policy has hamstrung the Federal Reserve to the point that for the Federal Reserve to do basic common sense macroeconomic stabilization, it's going to hit the national debt hard because Congress has been so irresponsible. Like I said, every point that rates rise, you add $30 trillion over 10 years, or over 30 years in interest costs. In fact, as recently as 2008, Washington was paying 5% interest rates on the national debt. So the idea that with inflation, with the end of the recession, with the baby boomers retiring, with productivity, that you're still never going to exceed 4.5% for 30 years. That's actually pretty optimistic.
Yeah, and the new normal after COVID will not look like the old normal of pre-COVID, I'm sure, for the economy, or for that matter, for the national debt, which is now on a much higher trajectory. We could talk about this all day, and there's a lot of fascinating stuff here to unpack, but unfortunately, we are out of time for today. That is Brian Riedel from the Manhattan Institute. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, that is Brian Riedel from the Manhattan Institute. You can check out his work and that new paper, that new report of his at manhattaninstitute.org. Find that online. Find our coverage of the national debt and everything going on in Washington and around the rest of the country at reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Bam. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
What is peace? Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA explains the deeper meaning of the word on this American Radio Journal commentary.
With Christmas so recently behind us, the phrase Prince of Peace may still echo in your mind. Its best-known occurrence is in the Old Testament book of Isaiah, the prophet. The full verse is, For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. That's from the King James Version. We often hear it at Christmas time. Although it was written at least 700 years before Christ, Christians generally take it as a prophecy of Jesus' birth. In fact, the phrase Prince of Peace is so closely identified with Christ that there are several Christian churches named Prince of Peace. Yet most of us have little idea of the full meaning of the word peace as used by Isaiah. Isaiah wrote in Hebrew, and the word he chose is shalom, translated into English as peace. We typically think of peace in a very simplistic sense, as the opposite of war. But in the Hebrew, it's a much fuller word with several more meanings than the mere absence of conflict. Shalom implies a wholeness, a kind of attainment of natural perfection. In contemporary political terms, we often recall Ronald Reagan's description of his foreign policy as peace through strength. That idea, that peace is an active rather than a passive concept, goes all the way back to George Washington. Here's what Washington said in his 1793 State of the Union Address. If we desire to secure peace, it must be known that we are at all times ready for war. As a former general, Washington knew that being ready for war requires both ready warriors and ready weapons of war. Is the shalom of Isaiah the active peace through strength of Ronald Reagan, or is it the more passive give peace a chance of the flower children and the advocates of unilateral disarmament? Many Christian worship services conclude with some variation of what is known as the Aaronic blessing, as found in the book of Numbers. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his face upon you and give you shalom, in the name of Yeshua, the Prince of Peace. Did you know that the original context of that Aaronic blessing is ironic? The scholar and theologian Brendan Faulks of Vancouver reminds us that God told Aaron to bless Israel with peace while they were getting ready to go conquer the Promised Land. If peace means the absence of war, then this doesn't make any sense. Soon they would be destroying cities. The Aaronic blessing is referring to an inner peace and completeness brought on by sharing in his countenance and his protection. That was the blessing that Israel needed. So it should be for us as well today. As we bid goodbye to the year 2021 and hope that the year 2022 is one of restoration of normalcy and the end of the COVID pandemic, let us pray a prayer of peace for our nation and the world. But let it be the peace of Isaiah, Aaron, Jesus, and Ronald Reagan, a strong, muscular, powerful peace, and a return to wholeness. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WGAO-FM in Franklin, Massachusetts, KIZA-FM in Verde Valley, Arizona, along with KGZP-FM in Prescott Valley, Arizona. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.